Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Asdeh Mashiri. Coming up on the programme, we'll discuss the launch of a NASA spacecraft on the hunt for signs of life, and we'll hear from our correspondent on the front line in eastern Ukraine as Russia makes advances on a crucial transport hub. But first, we start with the latest on the war in the Middle East and a rare Israeli strike in the north of Lebanon. The Lebanese Red Cross says at least 21 people have been killed in the village of Aitu. It's known as a Maronite Christian village with several churches and about 1,000 residents. Israel is yet to comment. George Katane is the Secretary General of the Lebanese Red Cross. I asked him to update us on what is known about the attack.
There's 21 casualties, dead bodies, at least 21. And there's two pieces of bodies, I'm not sure for DNA and check from the police, and they will see later. And 9 injuries. And we are continuing to check to see, because the building is 3-4 floors. And we have a USAR team, urban search and rescue team from the Red Cross, and our ambulance also, with civil defense working with us.
And tell us more about this region, because it is extremely rare, isn't it, for there to be a strike in the north?
It's a touristic and peaceful region.
Is it primarily Christian?
It's a Christian area, majority.
And when you say it's a peaceful area, it's a touristic region, right now, are there people who are trying to escape the violence in the south? Does it also have displaced people there?
Yeah, you have displaced everywhere. You have more than 1.2 million displaced and who left the south suburb of Beirut and Dubika.
And so, based on what you're describing, what areas of Lebanon are there any that you believe are safe right now?
We don't know if it's safe or not. We don't know where they are attacking or not. But what we know, you have a conflict, a fight in the south, according to the blue line, from Tyr to Sheba. And now they start in Mount Lebanon and in the north. Since last Saturday, they start bombing airstrikes in the north. And today, as you realize, until now, we have our teams there with a lot of others trying to do search and rescue to see how they can help.
Now, the Israeli military has said that it is investigating the incident, but it's also said that it is only targeting terrorists and it is not targeting any civilians. I wonder, when you look at the reality on the ground right now, how safe civilians feel in Lebanon, and what support are you providing?
There is no respect of international humanitarian law. This is one point. For us, we are serving and trying to save lives of any human being who needs us. When you have women and children and men, that you don't know who is the fighter. There's no fighter. I'm not talking about arms that are others. I'm talking about injured, wounded, and casualties when I arrive and I found them in a civil building.
The Israeli military and the government have denied that they're breaking any international law. When you're there on the ground, what are you witnessing in terms of the reality for civilians who are caught up in this?
Let me tell you, as a national society, and according to the fundamental principles of Red Cross, Crescent, neutral, especially as a humanitarian national society, neutral, independent, impartial. Later on, we'll see how we have to protect, it's according to IHL or not. For us, we have to help and support any human being who calls us. This is the role of the movement of Red Cross at present, to help, to serve, and to give hope to these people, to tell them, we are with you to help you and to serve you.
That was George Katane, the Secretary General of the Lebanese Red Cross. Well, in other developments in the Middle East, Israel has experienced one of the deadliest attacks by Hezbollah in a year of fighting after a drone attack killed four Israeli soldiers at an army base south of Haifa on Sunday night. Next on NewsHour, though, we're going to look closer at hunger and the threat of famine in this war. Today, a food distribution centre in the Jabalia refugee camp was reportedly targeted by Israel. That's according to UNRWA, the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency, talking about Gaza. Now, they say 10 people were killed and 30 injured as the centre came under fire. The Israeli military said the details of the incident are under review, with a spokesman adding that strikes and operations are directed only against terror targets and operatives and do not target civilians. At least 50 more people are said to have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza over the past 24 hours. That's according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Michael Fakhri is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the right to food. What does he fear could happen in Lebanon?
Right now, what we're seeing in Lebanon is Israel is expanding its campaign in the region. And what we're seeing is more and more civilian casualties, more and more civilian structures being destroyed. Already, Lebanon's situation in terms of hunger was precarious. And now there's a significant fear of Israel raising the stakes, and there'll be significantly more hunger and more death in Lebanon.
And so should Israel heed your warning, what should they be doing to ensure civilians have access to food in Lebanon?
Israel's not heeding anybody's warning. Israel has been attacking the United Nations, both in terms of politically and militarily. Israel is flouting international law. It's been flouting human rights law. It's been against the Security Council. So nothing anyone can say in terms of words is going to affect Israel whatsoever. The only way Israel is going to end its starvation campaign against the Palestinians, and now its war expanding into Lebanon, is if the United States, Germany, and other allies stop financially and militarily supporting Israel.
Well, we're touching on Gaza as well, because, of course, the situation there is devastating. There is an ongoing case in front of the International Criminal Court, and the ICC prosecutor included the charge of starvation as a war crime. Israel has strongly denied any of those allegations. It's also said in the past that estimates about how much food is needed in Gaza are wrong, and has also in the past said that the UN is failing in its distribution of the food. What's your response to that?
First and foremost, one has to understand the definition of starvation in international law. And the definition is the denial of the necessities of life, the denial of food, water, and housing. Israel announced its starvation campaign on October 9th of last year and continues to announce its intent. Just on September 30th, they imposed a full siege against all of northern Gaza, denying the entry of all food, water, and fuel, with the exception of one small shipment of fuel that was allowed in the last 13 days. So Israel has announced its intent to starve Palestinians in Gaza. It's implemented its starvation campaign, and we've seen the effects of their starvation campaign with high mortality rates. People are dying, not just from hunger, but from dehydration and from disease, which often follows. So Israel has told us what it's doing. It's actually done it, and we've seen the effects. Sometimes Israel will say that humanitarian aid is reaching people. The UN has said we're ready, and it's been reported to me directly that from humanitarian organizations that the rules are opaque and absurd.
Well, so to that point, today an Israeli military official has said that the World Food Programme has delivered, in his words, truckloads of food to Gaza in the north this afternoon. What's your assessment of the situation there?
That doesn't tell me anything in terms of how Israel is going to stop its starvation campaign. It just imposed a total siege for 13 days. So even if that's true, what are in those trucks? How many trucks? And I can't imagine any number of trucks that are going to address a year's long worth of starving people. What is needed is thousands of trucks, and they need to go in immediately, and there needs to be a ceasefire. So even if those remarks by the Israeli official are true, that does not in any way respond to the issue that Israel is starving Palestinians and has been starving them for an entire year.
And briefly, you are going to be presenting your report to the UN General Assembly. I assume you're going to repeat a lot of what you've said.
Indeed, and what I do in my report is I answer the question, how was Israel able to starve 2.3 million civilians in Gaza so quickly and so completely? We've never seen a starvation campaign like this in modern history. We've never seen so many people starved so quickly.
That was Michael Thackeray, the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food. And we did ask both the Israel Defense Forces and the Israeli government for an interview today. Nobody was available to speak to us. Let's turn to India now, which has withdrawn its ambassador and other diplomats from Canada after they were named as persons of interest in an investigation into the murder last year of a Sikh separatist. India's foreign ministry has also expelled six Canadian diplomats and ordered them to leave by Saturday. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasanath Rajan, gave me the details.
Let's rewind a bit. In June 2023, a Sikh separatist activist was shot dead in British Columbia. He was a Canadian citizen. And in September 2023, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, made a dramatic allegation that they were looking into allegations of links between this killing and agents of the Indian government. In effect, what people inferred from that speech was that some Indian government agents were linked to the killing of the Sikh separatist leader. Even though there is no broad support for Sikh separatist insurgency in India's Punjab state, there are hundreds of thousands of Sikhs living in the US and in Canada, and they still have meetings about a separate state. So this has always been an irritant in relations between India and Canada. Now, the Canadian police and the investigative committee, they have come out with a report saying that they have credible evidence to suggest the links between the Indian agents and what's going on in Canada about homicides and violence. And that's what we saw when the Canadian government said the High Commissioner of India and some diplomats as persons of interest into the investigation. Then India reacted by withdrawing its diplomats and also expelled senior Canadian diplomat. So this has now really escalated.
And there are 750,000 Sikhs who live in Canada, correct? So what has India been saying?
Now, what India has always objected to Canada was about the activities of some of the Sikh separatist groups and individuals in Canada. And they say that they are inciting tensions, they are inciting violence against the other Indian community in Canada. And Canadian example is not only isolated. In fact, in the US, there was also an allegation of an assassination attempt against another Sikh separatist leader. In fact, the State Department says that an Indian committee is going to visit them this week to discuss about what they have done, because there were also allegations that Indian agents were linked to the murder. So India is now walking a very tight diplomatic rope between US and Canada.
That was our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etharajan. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, as three economists win the Nobel Prize for their work on the impact of European colonisation on prosperity, we hear from one of them on why democratic institutions are key.
Now, no democracy is perfect. Everybody's got their weaknesses, to be sure. But thinking that you can be prosperous, run a rich country, line the pockets of the people at the top indefinitely without broader political representation, I think that's pretty hard to pull off.
And our top stories this hour. The UN has accused Israel of trying to cut the north of Gaza off, while killing large numbers of civilians in intensifying strikes. In Lebanon, a presumed Israeli attack in the north has killed more than 20 people. And Lily Ledbetter, a key figure in the fight for equal pay for women in the US, has died at the age of 86. This is Azadeh Mashiri with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Now, in China, people are following the US election with keen interest, but also some anxiety. They fear that whoever wins the White House could have an impact on several aspects of life, at home and abroad. Some Chinese analysts have said the choice between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump is akin to two bowls of poison for the country amidst growing concerns that intense competition between the two, China and US, could veer into conflict. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker visited a local park in Beijing to gather some thoughts from people there.
In a clearing in the trees, a pensioner is in full song as he elegantly spins his partner. The music is Chinese, but the dance is Latin. This group of seniors meet here regularly to learn new moves. And as the US election approaches, its impact on the two superpowers is on their minds.
I'm worried that the Sino-US relations are getting tense, which is a zero-sum game. It does no good to China or the US. As ordinary people, we hope the two countries can coexist peacefully with each other so that they can both develop.
There are also concerns about another trade war, and many feel the US is imposing tariffs on China's goods to suppress its growth.
The tariffs will also increase the burden to the US people. Increasing tariffs will cause the increase of life expenses, and ordinary people will suffer in the end. The two countries should work for win-win instead of destructive competition, which is not good for both sides.
Instead of watching the dancers, many gather to listen and add to our conversation.
I prefer Trump, although he imposes economic sanctions on China. He does not wish to start or fight a war. Biden starts more wars, so more ordinary people dislike him. It's Biden who supports Ukraine at the war, and both Russia and Ukraine suffer great loss from the war.
This echoes a key message from Chinese state media, which has been quick to blame the current Biden administration for its unwavering support of Israel and Ukraine. China portrays itself as a peacemaker and the US as a troublemaker. As his four-year-old plays on the slide, this father believes Kamala Harris will keep a cooler head when it comes to one of the biggest flashpoints between the US and China. Taiwan.
I don't think there's a good future. It's a global economy. I don't want my son to go to the military.
China claimed the self-governing island of Taiwan as its own, and President Xi has said reunification is inevitable, vowing to retake it by force if necessary. Joe Biden has insisted the US would defend it, and if Kamala Harris agrees, some fear it could lead to conflict. As we walk through the park, past stalls selling grilled octopus, we find 17-year-old Lucy on an exercise bike. She hopes to study in America one day.
I'm quite excited to see there is a female candidate. Harris' candidacy marks an important step forward for gender equality. And it's encouraging to see her as a presidential candidate.
Why do you think it's so difficult between the US and China?
Previously, China lagged behind the US. But now China has risen up in all aspects, which may lead to the US worrying about their number one place in the world.
There is a lack of trust on both sides. And most people we talk to believe that no matter who wins the White House, that will not change.
That was our China correspondent Laura Bicker there. Now let's turn to Germany. A landmark ruling there has found a former Stasi officer guilty of murder. Now that's the first time a former member of the East German secret police has been found guilty of the charge. The officer is now 80 and has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for murdering a Polish man, Czesław Kukuczka, who was attempting to flee the West to West Berlin 50 years ago. Details of that killing had remained unknown for decades after the Stasi secret police shredded files relating to the case. And that was before communist East Germany reunified with the West in 1990. Stefan Apelius is one of the historians who uncovered the case in the archives.
This is really a courageous and groundbreaking judgment in Berlin. I can only congratulate the judges. Czesław Kukuczka was treacherously murdered. And in other cases I know in the years before, judges were very often not very courageous to do something. This is the difference in this case.
Stefan Apelius there. Well, for more on the story, we spoke to Katja Hoyer, author of Beyond the Wall, The History of East Germany.
We're basically talking about a Polish individual who was trying to cross the Cold War divide in Berlin, so across the Berlin Wall into the West. And he did that by basically claiming to be a terrorist. So he claimed to have a bomb in a suitcase. And if he wasn't allowed across, he would detonate it. The Stasi, that's the East German secret police, worked out pretty quickly that this was a bluff, but still saw him as a threat because he was a foreign individual, did this in public, basically, which could have caused some sort of international incident. And so they basically told him he's free to go. And as he walked across, he was shot in the back by a hidden Stasi officer. And this was a case that happened 50 years ago. But the details were only discovered now, which is why there was a court case about it now.
And he was found guilty of murder. That's the first time that's happened in the case of a former Stasi officer. Why is that?
For murder, you have to prove intent as well as malice. And when you're operating within an institution, that is quite difficult to prove since these people operate on orders. And so by and large, if killings happened, they were usually treated as manslaughter because the person actually executing the murder or the killing doesn't necessarily have that intent to kill that person, but is simply being told to do that.
He was 38 years old at the time. Do we know why Mr. Kukuczka risked his life trying to cross?
As far as I know, that seems to be a little bit of a mystery because, as you say, he was kind of in the middle of his life. He had three children as well and a family, basically, in Poland. And the manner in which he did it was, to say the least, quite unusual. In the sense that, you know, most of the people trying to cross were trying to do it secretly, above or underneath the wall or, you know, across the so-called green border, the long border in Germany that separated East and West. But there were other ways of doing it. And the fact that, you know, he chose this very spectacular way of doing it, you know, makes the case even more mysterious.
And could you remind us, for anyone who doesn't remember or isn't familiar with that history, why people would risk their lives to escape?
Most of them had relatives in West Germany. It's easy to forget sometimes that families were split in two by the Cold War divide, and particularly in Berlin, where the wall was being put up overnight. Others left because they simply felt oppressed by the dictatorship in the East and wanted to live in a freer society. Many, many people left because of the economic circumstances just to seek a better life.
And Katja, today, how are former Stasi officers viewed in German society?
It happened quite a lot in the 90s that people were starting a new position, and then a few years later, there'd be a major scandal because, you know, somebody found their file or found out that actually they did work for the Stasi. And that would quite often mean the end of their career and they'd have to resign. So by and large, it was quite difficult for former Stasi personnel, people who directly collaborated with the Stasi, to get back into society.
That was Katja Hoyer. You're listening to the BBC's NewsHour.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh!
The BBC Director General Tim Davie gave a speech today saying that the world faces an all-out assault on truth as cuts to the funding of the BBC and in particular to this channel, the BBC World Service, and its dozens of language services has meant the vacuum is being filled by Russian and Chinese broadcasting. The World Service used to be funded directly by the Foreign Office, although it's always maintained editorial independence of government. That changed a few years back, and the BBC has been paying for the World Service, aimed principally at an international audience, out of its own budget, funded by what it's called the licence fee, which is paid by British households. Tim Davies has been speaking to my BBC colleague Nick Robinson.
If you look at the long-term trends, this is about decades of strategy where I think malign powers, frankly, Russia, China, others, see the benefit of investing heavily in media, you know, bordering into pure propaganda, but often just taking media assets, taking frequencies and broadcasting in a world which 75% of the world now doesn't have a free press. I mean, we obsess a lot about the ins and outs of the BBC, appropriately, but if you look at the big macro trends, they are disturbing. More and more, you cannot speak your mind. You can't have the process we're going through in terms of a free press interrogating politicians. And the World Service is a precious, incredibly important asset that we need to nurture. And that goes beyond just, frankly, BBC campaigning.
You talk about taking frequencies. Now, there was a big change, wasn't there, where the BBC was asked to pay for the World Service. It used to be done directly
indeed
by the Foreign Office. And some language services closed. Are you arguing today in this speech you've got at the Future Resilience Forum that Russia and China are filling that gap?
Well, we see that. We see where we withdraw. So, as an example, in Lebanon, and we haven't closed a lot of language services. What we've had to do, inevitably, as the BBC has had tight funding settlements, and there's only so much you can ask of the UK licence fee payer to pay for language services appropriately. And as you say, for decades, this was funded by government. And I think there are very clear examples where we've seen where we've taken away BBC Arabic on radio, for instance. It's on other platforms. Others have come in, Russian-backed media coming into Lebanon. And I've got other examples where you see China and Russia deliberately spending billions of dollars, Nick, billions on that strategic objective. This has to be a matter long-term for the central government decision-making to say, OK, we have to, as a country, invest. And I don't think it's appropriate to charge all of this to the UK licence fee payer. It is a strategic decision. One of the things that I think we should value, I mean, in this country, we do self-flagellation pretty well. But if you go around the world, by the way, if I want cheering up, get on a plane pretty much anywhere and talk about the BBC World Service, the things we do to build the most trusted news service in the world, that, I agree, Nick, is something that every household should not be paying for, things that they don't consume.
Are ministers listening?
I think they are.
That was the BBC's Director General Tim Davies speaking to my colleague Nick Robinson. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Azadeh Mashiri. The Europa Clipper spacecraft has launched from Florida on a mission to hunt down signs of life.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff.
The spacecraft, which is bigger than a basketball court, is part of NASA's first mission to Jupiter in a decade. It's headed towards the mysterious Europa moon, but it won't get there anytime soon. Europa is 628 million kilometres from Earth, and the spacecraft isn't expected to arrive until 2030. But once there, the mission could change what we know about life in our solar system. To learn more, we spoke to Professor Lee Fletcher, a director of research at the University of Leicester and a member of the Europa Clipper science team.
I've been involved in the Europa Clipper mission since its first inception several years ago now. This is a project that's been going on for more than 20 years. And so to see it launched this afternoon out in Cape Kennedy in Florida is an absolute dream come true.
And could you elaborate on what is meant by signs of life?
So this mission, Europa Clipper, is designed to go out to one of Jupiter's most enigmatic moons, the moon Europa. And what we think is going on deep down below the surface of Europa is that it has a hidden ocean, a saltwater ocean that's sandwiched between a layer of thick ice and the seafloor, the rocky seafloor. And within that deep, dark, hidden ocean, we believe there might just be the right ingredients for life to find a way, for biology to get to work within that icy, ocean-rich layer.
Do we mean furry creatures or something far more subtle than that?
This is not a mission that's necessarily going to discover the existence of life on Europa, but what it is looking for are those key ingredients that would be making the environment suitable for life. So it would have the energy it needs, the water it needs for chemistry to occur in, and crucially, the existence of some compounds, some elements, some minerals that we believe are the basic building blocks of life. And if we discover that the deep, dark, hidden ocean of Europa is indeed habitable, if it has that right blend of conditions, then I think you'll find a whole raft of future missions will be sent back to this moon in orbit around Jupiter to try to discover the existence of life. Now, I think we're going to be at the level of simple microbes, bacteria, so very simple forms of life. But of course, life is so versatile when we look at it here on planet Earth. It always finds a way to inhabit the most exotic and extreme niches in our own environment. So maybe the life on Europa, if indeed it does exist, maybe, just maybe, it's in a form that will be completely alien to us.
And you said you were delighted about the launch. What did it take to get here? There were challenges, weren't there? Even Hurricane Milton was a challenge, for example.
It seems that this mission has had hurdles to overcome right from the very beginning. It's a very expensive mission. It's a very challenging mission. When this spacecraft gets out to Jupiter, it's going to be pummeled by a very powerful radiation environment. The Jovian magnetosphere is a giant particle accelerator, sending a blizzard of these high energy particles into our sensitive computers and sensitive equipment. And so it had to be designed to really deal with that immense challenge of being out there. And then, of course, here on Earth, it had Hurricane Milton, which delayed the launch of the spacecraft by a few days to this morning out at Cape Kennedy. And amazingly, the blue skies over the Cape Kennedy today were just glorious to see as that rocket was leaving the Earth and going up into space. And then just recently, we've seen our beautiful spacecraft separate from the rocket fairing, dial home and tell us that it's all okay. And now it's going to embark on this 5.5-year mission out to the Jupiter system.
That was Professor Lee Fletcher. Well, this year's Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics has been awarded to Darren Acemoglu, Simon Johnson and James Robinson for their work on the impact of European colonisation on the prosperity of colonised countries. The Swedish Academy of Sciences said their research helps us understand how what they called an inclusive system made former colonies richer, while an extractive one made them poorer. Simon Johnson is one of the winners. He's Professor of Global Economics and Management at MIT in the US. He explained what they meant by inclusive institutions.
Inclusive institutions is actually something that people in the UK worked on for a long time, perhaps even before most other people around the world, fighting hard for democracy. It's the legacy of the Chartists. It's the legacy of the early trade unionists. It's the legacy of parliamentary reform, William Gladstone, and so on. And those ideas have spread in different ways. Obviously, it's not one size fits all around the world, but fighting for representation, fighting for voice, and fighting for economic rights. So the right to own property, the right to have that property protected against arbitrary seizure and so on. These are things that maybe in Britain we take for granted now, but they're things that had to be fought for hundreds of years. And they're things that are not yet available, sadly, in some parts of the world.
Are there examples then of where colonization has been good for countries?
Well, we should be careful with the word good, because obviously indigenous people, almost without exception, suffered when the Europeans came. And that suffering in many cases has lasted through to today. There are places, geographies, where richer societies have developed because the institutions the Europeans brought, that developed based on that European legacy, were more positive and were more inclusive. But there's a lot of work to do, definitely in the country like the United States, even I'm sure people will tell you this in Australia and New Zealand as well.
And you can't change history, but could this have an impact on reducing income inequality in the future, as the Nobel Committee has suggested?
Yeah, so you obviously can't change history, but you can understand history and you can appreciate how you got to the current place and position. And you can recognize the constraints that creates, but also the opportunities. So we've always looked for space around which you could create more inclusive institutions and make those more robust so they don't get taken over or undermined by people with autocratic tendencies, for example.
And what sort of countries pointed you towards these conclusions? What are some examples?
The three of us came in, I think, through our own paths. My path was through working 10 years in the former communist bloc in Eastern Europe, quite a lot in Poland and other countries. And in the former Soviet Union, I spent a lot of time in Ukraine, for example, and some time in Russia. And I was disappointed by the fact that some standard tools of economics and the way we thought about policy were not that effective in those settings. And that pushed me to understand something more about corruption, something more about the informal economy when people don't register their companies. And that pulled me towards this issue of representation and voice and what political rights people have and the way in which that's intertwined with economic rights and your ability to have a good job and to keep that job and for your kids to do better than you do. Now, no democracy is perfect. Everybody's got their weaknesses, to be sure. But thinking that you can be prosperous, run a rich country, line the pockets of the people at the top indefinitely without broader political representation, I think that's pretty hard to pull off.
Where is the legacy of colonialism the most evident to you?
Oh, the legacy of colonialism, I think you can see that throughout the former empire. And you can see it, for example, throughout the former British Empire. Places where Britain was very harsh and very extractive, for example, in West Africa, struggle today with poverty reduction and with, you know, keeping children alive. Places that have had better institutions under the British because they wanted to encourage British people and Europeans to move there, like Australia and New Zealand, have done better. So those are both colonial legacies on two sides of that coin. But the United States, I have to say, because I live in the United States, I'm well aware of the sort of split legacy. On the one hand, some aspects of the US come from a better treatment by the British, and they encouraged more Europeans to come to the northern and eventually the western parts of the United States. But let's remember the slave trade.
Professor Simon Johnson, now a Nobel laureate. Now, a special report on NewsHour. The number of migrants crossing the Atlantic Ocean on a treacherous route from West Africa to Spain's Canary Islands has reached an all-time high. It's now one of the main gateways to reach Europe. The BBC has gained unprecedented access to the migrants prepared to take the dangerous crossing. Ephraim Gabret reports.
It's early morning, and a group of migrants crowd together on a traditional fishing boat as it leaves the beach in Senegal. Among them is farmer Mohamed Wali. He's never been to sea before, but is embarking on a perilous journey to try to reach Europe.
Wow, guys, you do it.
I am asking you to pray for me. The time has come.
He's agreed to pay people smugglers $1,000 if he makes it across, leaving behind a wife and young children, in the hope he can better support them once he's there.
Nobody knows what could happen to me in these waters. But you have to take risks. If you don't have money, it don't matter. I'm their only hope, and I don't have money.
Strong currents, towering waves, and relentless wind await this group of mostly young men on a journey of more than 1,000 kilometers across the Atlantic. They each have just a few bottles of water and a handful of biscuits to last them more than a week at sea. More than 30,000 migrants have made it by boat to the Canary Islands this year, more than double the figure from the same period last year. Almost all of them are sub-Saharan Africans, fleeing poverty and conflict made worse by climate change. But officials on the Canary Islands say what awaits them on the rocky shores is an overwhelmed system at breaking point. In an exclusive interview with the BBC, the president of the Canary Islands government, Fernando Clavijo, described an oversaturated emergency system where sea rescuers, police and Red Cross volunteers are stretched beyond their limits.
Every 45 minutes, a migrant dies trying to reach our beaches. This means trafficking mafias are increasingly becoming more powerful.
To better understand these criminal networks, the BBC spoke to one local smuggler organizing boat trips to the Canaries.
If you take a big boat, one that can carry 200 to 300 people, and each of them pay around $500, we are talking about a lot of money.
The UN's Office on Drugs and Crime estimates that criminals make around $150 million a year on this route. When challenged about his role in this deadly trade, the smuggler was unrepentant and tells us there's no shortage of people who are willing to risk it.
It's a crime. Whoever gets caught should be put in prison, but there is no solution. You will see people in the water who have died, but the boats keep going.
The Canary Islands government fears the worst is yet to come. Historically, the Mediterranean Sea has been the primary route for African migrants to reach Europe. But since the European Union introduced stricter security measures and struck agreements with North African countries, it's made it more difficult. Fernando Clavijo says it's one major reason that the longer route from West Africa to the Canary Islands is becoming more popular. For 5 days, the BBC heard no news from Mohammed. Then, one evening, he called. He was back in Senegal. He explained that his boat had been less than a day away from reaching the Canary Islands when it started having problems.
The motor was heating up and the wind was so strong.
He said many on board feared the winds would pick up even more as they ventured further into the Atlantic Ocean and they decided to turn back to Senegal. Mohammed told us he spent most of the journey standing up because of a lack of space and he slept in seawater mixed with fuel. He also ran out of water, so he had to drink from the sea. All of this has left him with injuries and health problems. But he says he's determined to try again to reach Europe.
That report was from Ephraim Gebreb from BBC Africa Eye. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. A reminder of our top story this hour. The UN has accused Israel of trying to cut northern Gaza off while killing large numbers of civilians in intensifying strikes. In Lebanon, a presumed Israeli attack in the north has killed more than 20 people. Michael Fakhri, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, shared his concerns with NewsHour.
What we're seeing is more and more civilian casualties, more and more civilian structures being destroyed. Already, Lebanon's situation in terms of hunger was precarious. And now there's a significant fear of Israel raising the stakes and there'll be significantly more hunger and more death in Lebanon.
Our other headlines, a row between India and Canada over the murder of a Sikh separatist has escalated with both countries expelling the other's top diplomats. And Lily Ledbetter, a key figure in the fight for equal pay for women in the US, has died at the age of 86. This is Azdeh Mashiri with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Now let's turn to Ukraine, where in the eastern Donetsk region, Russia has advanced swiftly in the past few months. The front line now just outside the crucial transport hub of Pokrovsk. Fighting in this sector is particularly intense, with the Ukrainian military reporting nearly 150 battles every day as it tries to stall Russia's momentum. Now just 2 months ago, the city was considered a relatively safe place. Around 14,000 civilians still remain in Pokrovsk, war-weary and many of them desperate now for the war to end at any cost. From the front line, the BBC's Yugita Lamai reports with Imogen Anderson and Sanjay Ganguly.
I'm at a Ukrainian military stabilization unit, which is not far from the front line outside of Pokrovsk. We can't identify its exact location for safety reasons. These are basically units that are about 10 to 12 kilometers from the front line, where the first line of medical treatment is available for injured soldiers. This is the hottest front line in the war. And they've told us that it's been really quite intense here over the last 1 or 2 months.
My name is Alexander. I'm chief of medical unit 25 Air Assault Brigade. It's the most dangerous line in all front lines. And of course, we have a lot of injured soldiers.
Even where we are here right now, we are under the threat of artillery strikes. And if we just stepped outside of this building, there's a threat of being seen and struck by Russian drones. It's about 2 hours from sunset, and we've just had about 6 or 7 injured soldiers brought in, some quite serious. There's one soldier who's just walked past who has a bandage to his eye, quite visibly it's bleeding. And we were told before his arrival that he was actually injured at 11 in the morning. But essentially the reason why it takes so long to evacuate is because they have to wait for a relatively safe time to evacuate because of the ever-present threat of bombs being dropped from Russian drones.
He has injury of face, skull,
skull trauma.
The delays have consequences. One of the soldiers has serious brain trauma. Another might have to have his arm amputated. In the past 24 hours, two have been brought in dead. What we see points to the ferocity of the battle for Pokrovsk and what it's costing Ukraine.
We're with an evacuation unit in an ambulance in the city of Pokrovsk. We've just crossed the train tracks. This is a major logistical and transport hub, and it's one of the reasons why defending it is so crucial. They're here to evacuate two elderly women, and one of them actually lives on the eastern edge of the city, very close to the Russian positions.
This is one of the most dangerous districts of the city, volunteer Serhii tells us. Eighty-year-old Nadia Lebed is disabled, living alone in the dark in her home. The volunteers we're with carry her out. "I'm going to fall," she screams. They reassure her. Once on the van, she cries, "I'm going to die. This damn war. Why does Putin want more land? Doesn't he have enough?" Another evacuee, Victoria, says she can't believe the front line moved so quickly to Pokrovsk.
"The neighboring towns have been wiped out and drones buzz near our windows all the time. I have constant panic attacks. We should negotiate. There's nothing left standing in the areas Russia has taken anyway."
There are pockets of destruction in Pokrovsk, but the city has not been bombed out in the way that we've seen other cities that have been fiercely fought over, like what we saw in Bakhmut, for example. But three quarters of the people who lived here have left, and the government is actively asking those who are still here to evacuate. And that's evidence of how quickly Russia's advanced here in the east. Up until 2 months ago, this was a safe pit stop. And now the front line's just outside Pokrovsk, and constantly you can hear the sound of bombardment from there.
Vadim fires a Soviet-era howitzer gun. It blows dust and dried leaves off the ground. In the relative safety of a bunker nearby, he tells us it's been nearly a year since he saw his family.
"Yes, we are tired. Many of our men have died. Many are wounded. Negotiations are necessary, but not on Russia's terms. They need to be on our terms."
That was the BBC's Yogita Lamai reporting with Imogen Anderson and Sanjay Ganguly. Now, orchestra conductors are often known for their facial expressions, charisma and passion. Dresden Sinfonica's new conductor has none of those qualities, but she keeps perfect rhythm and is never prone to temperamental outbursts. Aina Aslam explains.
As the orchestra plays, three bionic arms wielding glowing batons that look like Star Wars lightsabers move up and down to guide the musicians along. Myra Pro-S, the robot conductor, made her much-awaited debut in the German city of Dresden this weekend. Some of the concert music was written explicitly to harness the technology, with 16 brass musicians and 4 percussionists playing wildly different time signatures. Myra is not the first robot conductor, but is perhaps the most technically advanced. Each baton guides a section of the orchestra as different parts speed up and slow down to create cross rhythms which would be impossible to conduct as a human. Dresden Sinfonica's artistic director Markus Rindt first thought of the idea more than 2 decades ago when a musician complained about his conducting and he replied, "I'm not a robot." But he insists robots won't replace humans.
"I believe a person can always do better. The rehearsal work, the facial expressions. If, for example, you were to play a Beethoven, you wouldn't need a robot like that. It's pointless. But if you have a piece that capitalizes on the fact that the orchestra plays at different speeds and different beats, then it makes sense."
Each robotic arm has 7 joints, allowing it to move and stretch in all directions. But if Myra gets a little too forceful, slamming down on the beat, a safety mechanism kicks in. One composer said the 2 years it took to train the machine made him realize just how wonderful a human conductor is.
That report was from Aina Aslam. Now that's all from us here in London at BBC's Broadcasting House. Goodbye from me, Asdeh Mashiri, and the NewsHour team, and thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.